theorist to design. So before I started the talk, I have, just like Philip Gegenbart had earlier, I have a second set of slides in case you ask questions on other things. And I just wanted to remind all of you that the question of temperature dependence, which was raised in the earlier afternoon sessions, is a very important one. And if you take data to low enough temperatures, no, it's not hard to distinguish between log and power law. These are data from the Maple Group, DeAndrada and co-workers, right, Brian? Yeah. And so on the uranium, copper, 4, palladium, which was already discussed by Vlad, and after I noticed him wince at the pronunciation of his last name by our esteemed chairman, I won't even try to attempt it because I'm sure Pierce did a much better job than I could ever. Yes, anyway, Vlad, as he discussed there. If you take these data to lower temperatures, as was shown by Scheidt and the Augsburg group, they do in fact follow the dashed line, the log, and it's not a question which is which. And then you see, you know, obviously we've seen Philip and the Dresden group's upturn where it actually diverges faster than the log, the power law. So, I'm sure we could discuss that. However, that's not my talk. Let me get back to my talk. And during the question period, which I know my chair will hold me to vigorously. Okay, so I'm not going to talk much about resistivity. I do have slides on it in that other storage area. Obviously, this gets organized in various ways, whether you're near a quantum critical point, whether you're not. Obviously, I only have time to talk about a few systems, but there are more data out there, and I'll try to at least mention some of it. We are not necessarily presupposing that this is a good theory, but in order to compare our data to a model, we've chosen this one particularly for the field data because it makes at least a theoretical prediction as to the form the data should take. And in fact, no model fits experimental data in anything close in its entirety. And so that's one of the caveats I want to put here. This is sort of like, this is a conclusion in the beginning. We shouldn't expect something as so intrinsically difficult and rich in its properties as a highly correlated system with disorder. We shouldn't expect that some closed theory sort of model could fit all of the complexities of such a system, let alone a number of systems. The other caveat I want to point out, and this is, of course, the dirty laundry which we experimentalists talk about with acceptance, but which theorists occasionally display shock, is there are often competing effects. I wouldn't go so far as to call them spurious, because someone might take that word and then ask me a question about spurious effects. But there are competing effects. For instance, if you're looking at low temperature, temperature dependence of one of these properties, and you happen to have a system that's close to magnetism, maybe it has magnetic order due to some other part of its electronic spectrum in a nearby temperature range, which prohibits you from fitting the pure temperature dependence that you know in your heart, because the theorist told you it was there, that you know in your heart is there to fit, because there's some bump in the susceptibility at 30 Kelvin that prevents you from fitting chi versus T in some convincing form. So there are competing effects, and I'll mention them as I roar by. This is not meant to be exhaustive. Before I get down here, I should mention various people that have contributed to data in this talk. First of all, there's the 180-some page thesis from Daniel Mixon, my grad student, whom I had the pleasure of reading on the plane. Or at least partially. There's Jung-Soo Kim. So, yeah, a lot of people contributed to this. Samples from John Serrao, consultations with Antonio Castaneda, etc. So, Obviously, we've heard about this earlier this afternoon, so I don't need to talk about it. This is just meant to be a bit of a historical perspective. There's a new paper by Fisher and Roche, which is starting to look at the field dependence of the specific heat, so there's another candidate to fit data to. Obviously, this has been discussed a little bit. And again, if I'm leaving someone out or not referencing your most recent work, well, it's your own fault. You didn't send me a preprint. And so I'll talk about the Griffiths phase, and I don't claim to understand it from a theorist's perspective. I would disagree with the dates which Vlad gave us when this work was published. He said 99 and 01. Now I would say 98 and 00, but that's okay. December 00 was in fact close to 01. So power law and these properties, and the interesting thing about this later paper is it talks about how you can get the same exponent lambda from higher field magnetization data. And in fact, experimentally, we do see this in several systems. So you're looking at low field susceptibility and specific heat, where you get a power law behavior in the Griffiths field theory. You determine lambda, and then you go to where actually the Griffiths phase clusters have been, the tunneling has been suppressed. You go above this crossover, this threshold field, and you get an exponent from fit to the magnetization data up where the Griffiths clusters are suppressed from tunneling, and you get agreement. So that was, oh, I'm sorry. I'm supposed to have been wearing a microphone?
Yes.
I'll talk more softly now. And then there's also this prediction for the temperature dependence and the field dependence of the specific heat. This is, to anticipate Chandra's question, this is like a Schottky anomaly with the serial numbers rubbed off. I don't think this is any great intrinsic insight. But it is. This is not a fittable parameter. This lambda comes from other measurements. So in fact, you only have two fit parameters here. You have some proportionality for the magnitude, and you have this mu effective, which hopefully gives you some sort of reasonable value like one mu Bohr. So we're going to use this theory. I'm not at all claiming that it's better or worse. We're going to focus on the field dependence of the specific heat. Obviously, we could do this in a number of models. And we've heard about this system before, and it's clear from these old data that this fit to the Kondo disorder model to the field dependence of this system doesn't work very well. Here are the data, here's the fit. But I should point out that the Griffiths phase model doesn't work for this compound either. So I'm not claiming I have my favorite model that fits everything. In fact, the specific heat, which I'll talk about a little later, goes as log T for this material, we believe. And as you apply field, and that's in the subsidiary slides, you don't induce a peak like the Griffiths phase Castaneda-Jones says should happen. And I might ask, is this compound disordered at all? Or is it good disorder? I know that Doug McLaughlin will tell you from his MuSR and NMR that it is disordered. But if, for instance, if you take as prepared stuff and you get Corwin Booth to tell you what fraction of the beryllium 1 site, let's see, let me actually go a little further along in here since we were having this done to us today. Here we go. If you take the gold beryllium 5 structure in which this compound forms, there's one larger beryllium 1 site and four smaller beryllium 2 sites. Palladium is larger than copper, so it has the possibility of preferentially going on the larger site. If you get Corwin Booth to go look at this with his XAFs and his co-workers, what you find out is that annealing and better order only take the palladium occupation in unannealed material from 73% on the beryllium sublattice site to 81%. So there's still obviously disorder. Doug McLaughlin's correct. There is disorder. However, you get an enormous change in properties for this change in disorder. You get a decrease in rho naught by a 2.5 you get a decrease in the negative coefficient of T in the resistivity by a factor of 10. So I think talking about the resistivity is a little difficult because of perhaps extraneous effects, and focusing on this system when you're talking about disorder is very risky, because at the minimum you've got enormous sample dependence depending on how quickly your sample cooled. And so it's not a good system to go look for. So let me now rush back. Sorry about this, but it's quicker than going to the laptop. Okay, so here we go. So we're going to focus on the specific heat and field. So we're going to talk about these three systems. This is Daniel Mixon's thesis. This is the 180-some page paperweight I brought with. This is work we did together with Joe Thompson and John Serrao in Los Alamos. This is work based on previous work done by Bodan and Andraka. And let me just start. Okay, so signature for the Griffiths phase would be power law in chi at low temperature and power law in C over T. And I know this is real hard to read. This is a particularly difficult system because they're single crystals, and so you can get exponents in both directions. So even though you may not be able to read this, the solid are for field in the basal plane, and the open symbols are for field perpendicular to the basal plane. The exponents vary, and I know these are very hard to read, at least in the back of the room. But let me just pick one. Let me pick field in the parallel in the basal plane for cerium 0.05, lanthanum 0.95, rhodium indium 5, which are these solid squares down here. And so this is minus 1 plus lambda. It's 0.86 with a minus sign in front of it. So lambda is 0.14. So maybe if we just focus on this one set of data, lambda is 0.14 from the temperature dependence of the susceptibility at low field. Okay, so it sort of fits the Griffiths model. One could argue this is not the most wonderful fit. It's not over a decade. We all have the problem. Most of us have the problem that we don't measure chi DC bulk down to low enough temperatures. The other interesting thing is this system is not at the quantum critical point. So I'm showing you behavior that I claim fits the Griffiths model, sort of fits the Griffiths model, way away from where TNL went to zero. This isn't a quantum critical point. This is a line of behavior in the phase diagram where you appear to have non-liquid behavior. Five percent cerium on the solid squares. For your edification, the next symbol up is 20%, and the next symbol up is 50%. Way away from where magnetism went away. So here is this claim in the Castaneda-Jones December 2000 FISREV B paper that M should be linear with H at low field, and above some crossover or threshold field, it should go as some power law of field. And this is not cheating. This line, which is approximately the best fit to within about 0.01, this line fit to these higher field magnetization data, it does in fact have a lambda of 0.14, which to me is amazing. John?
Yeah. With this level of dilution, why would you simply expect a single ion tunnel system with maybe a spin glass potentially a field?
In many cerium systems we have looked at, for example, cerium copper 2, silicon 2, when you go to the dilute limit, you get bizarre interaction effects, even though it's dilute.
Why? It's still concentrated.
5% is a bunch.
5%?
Is a bunch.
But suppose you went to 1%.
Eventually, yeah. I mean, look, there are a lot of uranium systems where you can get single ion behavior. There's one cerium system. Cerium lead 3, doped with lanthanum. Crow and company stuck us with that, and that's all in your memory banks. You all believe that. You say single ion behavior in cerium lead 3 doped with lanthanum. But if you dope with thorium, you don't get single ion behavior. In the very same system, there's one example in cerium where you get single ion behavior. One.
No. The Kondo effect was really proven. We are doubled a spin a half into the theory magnificently 20 years ago when the cerium lanthanum dilution was either hexafluoride or aluminum.
Okay, I'm talking about the whole phase diagram where you went from 100% cerium down. Okay, I was talking about concentrated to dilute, and I would claim that 5% is still fairly, but anyway, all I'm showing you are data. You're asking me why? No, ask the theorists around you. Okay, so point this out. So now remember, we're supposed to get the specific heat in field divided by temperature above the crossover field, and the crossover field, let me remind you, was somewhere between 0.8 and 1.2 Tesla down here. So above this crossover field, you get a different kind of scaling in the Castaneda-Jones picture. Above, of course, is an elastic term. Experimentally, we see about a factor of 2. So if you get above that crossover field by about a factor of 2, experimentally, we start seeing peaks in the specific heat that seem to obey their model. So in other words, the crossover field, let's say it was 1.2 Tesla. If you go to 1.5 Tesla, you do get a peak in this material, which sort of follows the behavior, but it looks much nicer if you're at 2 Tesla, and it looks really pretty at 3, okay? Now, this is just to point out, don't forget, we're talking in zero field of a quantum Griffiths picture, so C over T has to go as T minus 1 plus lambda. So in zero field, the dots, you see this upturn at low temperature. So it does diverge as a power law at low temperature. Don't get confused by the fact that at higher fields you also see upturns. So for instance, pick the diamonds in 13 Tesla. Those splittings above 3 Tesla, and you already start to see a little curvature in 3 Tesla. 3 Tesla, remember, what we're doing with the field is we're suppressing the tunneling in the quantum Griffiths. So in 3 Tesla, you get rid of the upturn that you see in the open dots, and you get this peak in the specific heat. So that's all consistent. Don't get confused by the fact that at 6, 9, and 13, you see upturns down here. Those are not non-Fermi liquid upturns. Those are just splitting of nuclear levels. Totally mundane. So here are the 3 Tesla data. Two free-fitting parameters, same mu, and I'm sure one can complain that's not a very good fit, but at least at the time we were fitting these data, there were other groups, I think Brian's amongst them, that had unexplained peaks in their specific heat with field, and we were at least pleased that we came this close. So at the time these data were published, we were quite happy with this kind of fit. I'm not saying this is a proof that Castaneda-Jones works for this system. I'm saying it's sort of consistent.
How many ceriums are involved in the cluster that is that
peak? You want to know magnitude? Pierce, I'm answering. Give me a chance to think. So the 3 Tesla peak is this one. I haven't subtracted anything or normalized anything here. So this is consistent. So if I look at the divergent behavior on this scale in the 0 Tesla, and I look at the induced size of the 3 Tesla peak, it's roughly comparable.
Yeah, but can't you extract quantitative numbers out of this kind of data? Can't you, for example, tell us what a typical size of the cluster is?
Okay.
Isn't that something that can come out of the...
I believe the theorist will allow me to answer no, because there's more than one parameter that fits the amplitude.
I think there's one thing that you can do.
Okay.
You have a single quantum picture, even if it's distributed. The Wilson ratio should be close to 2. Because a single spin, it works just like not a single quantum spin. You have a cluster. The cluster has a presumably much larger magnetic moment than one Bohr moment, no? Whereas the entropy is 2, log 2. So the Wilson ratio should be very different in the magnetic
Griffiths
space picture
than
in the
solar. Okay, thank you. I'll go home and analyze the data. The mu effective for this fit was 1.25 Bohr magnetons. Okay, remember that form that we've had there? I honestly, you want to know the concentration of clusters. Doesn't that also depend on the size? In order to fit the amplitude, you're talking about the amplitude of the specific heat. Don't I have to know splitting and size?
Even if it's 5%
cerium.
It would be interesting to know what the size of the typical cluster is. Griffith's phase calculations are based on the idea of a typical cluster.
So big cluster.
You get big clusters, and if I may say so, what
big would it be?
To look at entropy, and from the entropy you can estimate what is the number of clusters which are free, right? And I think that such estimate can be done. We have done estimates. Turns out that the average distance between free clusters is 3 to 5.
Okay. Thank you. That was 2 minutes out of my discussion time. I now have to hurry. Thank you. Other composition. I'm not picking on you, Piers, but you're going to pick on me in 10 minutes.
The idea is not the quantity of material that you cover, but the quality of discussion and the development of understanding that comes.
I don't know the answer to your question right now. Is that sufficient? Thank you very much. Okay. So here's another composition. Here's another fit. Here's another system. Notice the power law dependence of the susceptibility. There is some remnant magnetism in these other compositions, so be aware that when you look at higher temperature properties, you can get something that says one thing, but it actually at lower temperatures, you may have some magnetism left over. Here is the same inverse. Excuse me?
Aren't they starting to be rather concentrated, if I saw that?
Yes. This is a concentrated system, and the next system is even more concentrated. Moving away from the first kind of system, this is supposedly at a quantum critical point. This is supposedly where TNAL goes to zero at 0.2.
Are the next ones getting bigger?
As I go, okay, well, hang on a second. This one here is minus 0.44. I actually have this written down somewhere else, but let me get it off the graph for you. This is, maybe I do have to get it off the graph. Okay, so lambda is 0.64 for the 0.2 sample, and then it goes 6156. So as you get away from the critical point, lambda is getting marginally smaller. So it goes from 6.4 to 5.6. Did that match some expectation on your part or violate it? While she's thinking, let me move on to the next slide.
Lambda should be smaller as the inverse of 50-12.
So that's
what you said.
Yes. Right, okay.
For the first system that you just talked about, did you also, how do the lattice scale there?
Right, but there we're away from the quantum critical point. There the lambdas varied all over from 0.14 for the dilute case, the ones that I ask you to remember, up to a lambda of 0.73 for the more concentrated case.
So that's even worse.
Okay, well, you're still far away from the magnetic transit, but okay, you're going towards it. Okay.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. You only shown for the comparison with the field data for one photon, for the 5% of the photon. Did you also do the analysis in comparison to the other two concentrations? Does the lambda that you get from C over T also correspond to the H dependence?
Yes.
For all three?
Yes. Yes, within 5%. Yeah. So,
Greg, an experimental question. I see a plot of a magnetic moment versus a field in two previous pictures. It goes up linear with field initially, as most things do, and then it curves over. So, and you fit these to a high field region and a low field.
Right.
To know what is the justification for fitting a smooth curve to two different functions.
Okay, this is linear, Bill.
Yeah.
And this is just some simple power law.
Which doesn't doesn't work all the way back to zero.
It's not meant to. It's not meant to. And
what's the justification for analyzing magnetization data that way?
The justification is it's a prediction of the Griffiths phase theory, and they tell us to go look for this exponent.
At high fields.
At higher fields, yes. But it does match the temperature dependence of the susceptibility. I'm amazed as well.
It's not a Milbon function.
I never said it was.
But it begins linear.
If I just have to interrupt you, because this is coming up over and over again. This same prediction, if you have linear and then parallel, comes out from any theory that has a parallel distribution energy state. It comes from this theory, it comes from the sort of common model, it comes from this. Any theory with a parallel distribution energy state will give you all these predictions exactly the same. So you're not saying that this is a prediction of one particular theory, you're just misleading, because he tells us that there's a parallel distribution, he doesn't tell us anything else.
Okay.
That's cool.
That's good.
It actually, Antonius and Barbara's theory actually predicts that the lambda actually becomes smaller as you go towards the limit. So unless there's some non-electronic behavior, what you found is actually, I think, just the opposite of what
they would. Well, if I get in the next 4 minutes to the last part of my talk, I'll show you where a lot of things don't match their theory, not just a few. Okay. So I want to point out that in this system, Pierce's question about the amplitude smaller, Pierce, and no, I don't know what it corresponds to in cluster concentration. And we have this possible dissipation flattening here. So this is a rather poor fit, and it becomes constant at low temperatures. And so Antonio's possible explanation for that was maybe dissipation destroyed the tunneling, and for what it's worth. Higher fields work a little better, but if I show you all the data, there's the 3 Tesla data, you see that's really not a very good fit at all. So moving along, we've done this retrospective. Annealing makes a big difference for the lattice parameter. Annealing makes a big difference for the specific heat in uranium, copper, 4, palladium. Maybe we need to study a system with better disorder. So what we do is, and there is work by other people on the nickel system, is instead of putting palladium here, where palladium likes to preferentially sit on the one beryllium, one larger site, we're putting nickel, where nickel is smaller than copper. So nickel is going to be strewn amongst the 4 smaller beryllium 2 sites. So we're guaranteed to have disorder through, yes, John, I'm right.
But they're neighbors. Copper and nickel have no vast size difference, right?
They're vertical neighbors. Yes, they do.
No, they're horizontal.
Okay, they're horizontal. Nickel and palladium are vertical neighbors. Nickel and palladium are isoelectronic.
Copper and nickel should mix very well.
They do.
And that's what you want in this compound. Whereas copper and palladium would have difficulty mixing.
Thank you.
Good.
Nickel goes on all 4 small sites and gives us a lot of disorder. As we go through, we notice that by accident, the hybridization takes TNAL down to 0 at around the same point. Here you can see TNAL being folded in the specific heat. And here, I'm actually going to get this in before Pierce shuts me off. If I go through the quantum critical point, here, if I go through the nickel 1 concentration and I look at the temperature dependence of the specific heat, I put the Maria theory, just weak fluctuation has nothing to do with order, through the data to show you that the Maria fit actually is a good fit to these lower concentration magnetic data, just to throw that out to you. The Maria fit, the dashed line, is not a terribly good fit at the quantum critical point, although it's telling you that this Maria parameter, why not, as it goes to 0, it's telling you that you're approaching the quantum critical point according to the fluctuation theory of Maria. The log T behavior looks rather nice at the quantum critical point. The power law behavior at the quantum critical point does not fit. Okay, so as you go through the quantum critical point in a guaranteed disorder system, there's no preferential occupation of some special beryllium 1 site. This is a disordered system, and the disorder is not changing much as I change the concentration by 10 or 5%. It's disordered, it's disordered, it's disordered. You see that you can get power law behavior on either side of the quantum critical point, but not at the quantum critical point. Further, we can look. And I never said in the beginning that I was saying that Castroneto-Jones was the only thing that predicted this sort of behavior, nor did I say that it was going to make correct predictions. As I look at whether I get a peak in the specific heat that's fittable by that rather simple approach, the answer is no at the quantum critical point. However, if I go, thank you, Piers, if I go up here to something over twice the crossover field, I get a decent fit in the Castroneto-Jones behavior of the specific heat peak. Thank you so much.
Spin symmetry of the systems we're talking about. Because the predictions are very different for the Ising systems, where we now know that at least at sufficiently low temperatures, we don't expect these surface pictures to hold. And the Heisenberg magnet, where that is a much better chance for it to hold. So therefore, it would be interesting to do a nice form game and test it people.
Well, in the indium 5 system, the anisotropy, do I have my support group here? John, did you leave? Yes, you did. The anisotropy is about a factor of 2 or 3 in the susceptibility. It's not very large. Uranium, copper, nickel is cubic. Well, but is it going to get to a two-dimensional Ising model?
If I can start by group, with many of these things, trying to call it Heisenberg or Ising, the reality is a little bit somewhere. I fear that you're not going to feel all that comfortable, except in very few exceptions, which usually are not hybridizing, to call it Ising. Heisenberg, do get away. You're not going to see hybridization because it's projected. So it's going to be somewhere in the middle. And you may have to look at that.
Yeah. Yes, but it's like 2 or more like 8 or 10 or something, right?
All of these are 3 and less than 4.
Right.
I mean, that's capricious, but I mean, that's sort of, I think, the module of it.
Okay.
Can you just say, what do you think is the entropy per spin in this temperature range where you're looking at specifically? Is it comparable to 1 kilo per spin, or it is, let's say, 2 or 3 orders of magnitude less than?
Oh, no, it's comparable. Let me just, I could, let me go to the system where the data were cleaner. And let me go to the dilute system. Not that one, this one. So this is a 5% system. These plots are per whole mole, okay? So I'm gonna multiply by 20 to get per spin, okay? So what you're asking is, what's the entropy under here, right? It's a triangle. It's 1/2 the base times the height. The height is like 80, and the width is a couple degrees. So then multiply that by 20, and it's around our log 2.
Well, that's not the answer to what you said. One of the numbers, I think the Griffin space picture, Thomas also said, means that you have large clusters, that's when you get these continuous distributions, and they're very dilute. If that's the case, then the entropy has to be 10^-3 of K log 2, and not of order 1.
Okay, well, of order 1. I think John is busy doing the arithmetic. It's like a third, but.
I think we should understand the orders of magnitude of numbers first before we look at details. If we have so much entropy, I don't see how the dilute clusters picture can possibly work. Okay. Well, just, we're talking 3 orders of magnitude here. We're not talking about little details. How can we have so much entropy and talk about the dilute clusters? I think?
You can't.
So in conclusion, this is quite inconsistent with the magnetic Griffith phase picture. Would anyone like to dispute that?
Well, I don't quite understand the argument about the entropy. I mean, I thought there were the action is coming in the quantum Griffith scenario from a very small number of rather big clusters.
gesture which dominates it. You could certainly have most of the spins can still be single spins. Is
but
that
this
not right?
Thing here is supposed to be coming from those things that are giving the action, no?
Yes.
Isn't it?
But it comes from...
This is not a shot.
Okay, so...
I mean, I want to throw another caveat in this discussion, namely that I don't think that anybody disputes that if you have damping, if you have coupling of the spin and the fermionic degrees of freedom, yes, damping on the system, that eventually you will just freeze out all the ordered islands, basically, as Thomas showed earlier today. Now, if that is the case, then you will have actually, for example, the spin system will be two contributions. You will have from the already frozen out classes, basically one over t superparamagnetic contribution. You will get a 1 over t to the minus 1 plus lambda from those droplets that still can tunnel. So this means that one should not just analyze, for example, the susceptibility data with one fit that goes as one as t to the minus 1 plus lambda, but strictly speaking, one has
a sum of terms
coming from
right.
The frozen islands and some contribution coming from those islands or droplets that can still tunnel.
Right.
Which, of course, makes this whole analysis much more difficult.
Right. So, if I could respond a little bit to Piers, if you're talking about wanting to look for 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3, I'm sorry, experimentally, you're not going to see it. All I'm telling you is that there are systems where when you put on a field, you look like you're getting something like a third, if you will, R log 2 of entropy under these field-induced peaks. Where that's coming from, it's not the rare spin clusters, but if you remember what I talked about in the last system, that's also, you know, none of the fits were very good. I'm just saying that sort of temperature and field dependence appears to be fitting real systems. That it's coming from rare spin clusters, no, but why is this I'm saying there are hints of what's behind the physical reality that are contained in various models. Okay, you might have noticed the Maria fit go running by that has nothing to do with disorder, right?
Well,
even those are disordered systems.
If you look at the entropy in this, it's consistent with something of order, an individual spin or some small number of spins, not large clusters, right?
Yeah.
And so the question would then be, how do you get these phenomenological fits from, in a fashion that's consistent with an object which has so much entropy?
Right. So this is a request to the theorist to go find something that's behind the behavior that's a little more concentrated. And thank you.
Right. Okay, time for one or two more.
This is a purely experimental one. So let's for a moment still assume that maybe the Griffith stuff is still an option. Isn't it so that what you would find in this plots would be very sensitive to annealing time? So if you take the sample, you annealing it for a couple of days at some reasonable temperature, then you would find a different distribution of your clusters. For example, in the chemistry of your sample.
Well,
if the concentration is the same, you just annealing.
Now, if you, for instance, let me just talk about, this system here. You can anneal this system. I'm not sure in this system that you could change the size of the cluster by annealing, because I think it's going to be disordered on a microscopic scale in every unit cell, whatever you do. So, John, you're shaking your head.
There's no metallurgical technique to detect this, right?
Right.
That's the problem. You have to use physics to do metallurgy.
Okay, but the answer is, if I may ask, answer as an experimentalist, is no, these answers don't depend on annealing.
Okay. Just a couple of questions. Someone has to distinguish between the tunneling or the different configurations that are out of equilibrium and the metallurgy that is out of equilibrium. The metallurgy we cannot change.
But of course, the tunneling you can change. I mean, by just doing different histories. But it's a little bit like in glasses, where you have an amorphous state that you cannot change, but you have a distribution of tunneling states that you can change. And an experiment to actually try to see whether that has anything to do with tunneling would be to heat up the sample to very high temperatures, then the oil whatever it is, equilibrate, and then quench rapidly, say from 30 K down to 100 millikelvin, and then measure the heat that is slowly flowing out of the sample, just staying at 100 millikelvin. And that's an experiment that has been done in glasses.
Right.
Although the heat capacity associated with the tunneling stage there is very low. So if that, these anomalies have anything to do with the tunneling, you would be able to see something like that.
Okay, well, I think tunneling in rare clusters is not likely to wind up being our explanation.
I thought that's behind the
difference.
It is, but I'm...
Entropy is wacky.
Well, there's other things that I hope I've put forward that, yeah.
You know, you think of something else to explain this remarkable data.
I would propose to do the Wilson ratio, which I'm not aware of even now.
Okay, I'm going to close off and go to the next talk. Thank you very much.